Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is my good friend and the official lawyer. He's the official Rebel Capitalist lawyer himself, Robert Barnes. Welcome back, buddy.
Good to be here.
All right. Well, you and I have this FOIA request going with the Fed. I mean, they were past their deadline, I think, in what, February was their deadline. They kept blowing us off. We requested all of this information prior to that. You texted me the other day and said that we've received word from them. So I guess that's a little bit of progress. What's going on?
So we made an expansive request, a request by both topic and transaction. The topical request included requests about communications concerning certain people, concerning certain transactions, concerning certain subject matters that covered the whole history of the Fed. And some of it was very specific audit tailored materials that you would do if you were an audit, a bank auditor. A bank auditor drafted that part of our FOIA request. And then we, you know, with the help of various people in the community as well, drafted for a whole bunch of different topical areas. They initially came back, and within the FOIA rules, they can request extensions of time. They exhausted all of those extension requests. They kept saying, don't worry, we're looking at this. We're getting it together. It's a lot of material. We just need a little more time. And they did four of those, and then they ran out of time by February. So I communicated to them in March that, you know, we're looking at suing unless we're going to get responses. And so then they suddenly assigned a high-ranking supervisor to the matter. Hmm.
Okay.
And they send back a communication, which presents an opportunity, but it was an interesting one. According to them, the Fed has no way to search for the materials we requested. According to them, the Fed doesn't know how to search by topic. They don't know how to search by transaction. They don't know how to search by individual. They don't know how to search by subject matter. And my favorite part was we had requested information concerning what has the Fed been talking about concerning the 16th Amendment, the scope of it, taxing cryptocurrency, taxing gold, taxing wealth, taxing unrealized gains. They came back and they said, we don't know what you're talking about, taxes. We have nothing. We don't know anything about taxes. That was the actual description of the report. So what they've done is effectively said, you've walked into our library. And we're not going to show you anything in our library unless you tell us what our Dewey system is.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's like the Dewey Decimal System. Yeah,
that's exactly right. Unless you tell us how we've organized our records, how we've archived our records, how we've digitized our records, unless you can give us that code, we can't give you anything. So, but to me, that really just opened up an opportunity. They could buy time of this tactic, fine. You know, we knew they would take these kind of delay tactics to them. But what they really did is they gave me a good idea, which was we should ask the Fed, what do they digitize? What do they archive? How do they store information? How do they access information? How do they record information? How do they train their FOIA people to access that information when requests are made?
Yeah, I mean, that could help out a lot of other people, too, that are either in the process of doing a FOIA request with the Fed or maybe other government agencies, and then people that will do that in the future. And that was one of our main goals here.
Exactly. I mean, we were just requesting certain things in the vault. They're now basically telling us we have to ask for the architecture of the vault, how the vault was designed, how the vault was structured, and what the code is to the vault. Well, that's fine by me. I was like, I hadn't even thought about asking for that. But that is dramatically expansive because then we can give everybody a roadmap to where everything is stored, everything is located, everything is identified. We can give them the code to the vault anytime they want for a FOIA request. So we're going to be filing an amended request that asks for all of that additional information. Say, okay, you're saying we have to know what the code is. Tell us what the code is. Tell us how the vault was structured. Tell us how it was designed. Tell us what goes into which safe deposit boxes. Tell us where the keys are. Tell us what the keys are. And then we'll come back with our request for the specific subject matter that we want within that structure. But this way, we're going to find out the entire entire Fed structure. Because personally, I have no doubt that they have digitized and archived massive amounts of these records.
Right.
I have no doubt they can search within a keystroke. Like we asked for, what have you ever said about Ron Paul? We're just kind of curious. Well, what's in the emails? What's in the memorandums? Tell us all the time, Ron. I can guarantee you they can type in somewhere at the Fed, Ron Paul, and find every communication, memorandum, email, or document concerning him. They're pretending that they can't unless we give them the code, the key, the password. So we're going to ask for the password. And that in turn will allow people to really be able to enter the FOIA vaults of the Fed forevermore. So it's going to be even more beneficial in the long term. They were so obsessed with buying time, they gave us a roadmap for how to unlock the vault permanently.
Yeah, they opened themselves up. Okay, so that was my next question. Is because we, or I shouldn't say me, because you did this amendment, I guess that sets the clock back to zero. So now they have another, what is it, 3 months, 5 months to respond to this, the amendment?
To a certain degree. We're going to phrase it and frame it as an amended complaint, as an amended request. Consequently, that puts them back on a regular 30-day timetable.
Okay.
So they would have to respond in June. What they may try to do is they may try to say, well, this amended request is really a new request and try to trigger the old timelines. They can get away with that. They can at least try that. And there's not much we could do about it aside from suing earlier rather than later.
Yeah.
But if it looks like we're going to ultimately get the new information, then we let them play out how much they can delay. If it looks like they're just going to do delay and never get it to us, we have earlier and easier grounds to sue now because it's technically framed as an amended complaint, which we got the right to because of how they chose to respond.
Right. And, you know, I don't think it's any more encouraging the way they responded because, I mean, if you think that through, let's just say that let's take them at their word and say that they don't have the ability to actually, you know, source those records or sort their, you know, electronically any emails that have pulled up the name Ron Paul or something like that, or they have no way of knowing what happened, you know, during the 2020 March when they set up that special purpose vehicle to buy corporate debt. There's just no way of knowing that within the Fed. I mean, that's even scarier than the Fed having the power in the first place, because now all of a sudden they've got the power and they're admitting that they're completely inept and completely incompetent.
Exactly. I mean, if the Fed is in a position where they can't even find out what somebody thought, say, in the late 60s or early 70s about inflation, that's more damning than what information likely would be given to us about those communications.
Exactly.
So that's where I see it as win-win. It becomes a court of public opinion win and a legislative reform. Because for those people that want reform of the Fed, they obviously run into hurdles in terms of real ending the Fed, but there are ways to chip away at it. Yep. And if we're able to document the Fed's not even keeping accessible information about their own policies and procedures about critically, historically relevant debates and discussions and conversations over time, then that's something that can be legislatively fixed. In other words, that's something that people could pass as a, you know, Rand Paul could push through a proposal that says, hey, let's just amend so that the Fed has to digitize and archive all their records for FOIA searchable purposes. That's a small legislative reform that would be much easier to pass than the whole scale one. So it opens up the possibility of legislative reform. My bet, like yours, is they absolutely have the means to access all these kind of records.
Yeah.
And they're just going to have to disclose it to us.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, I appreciate that update. And obviously, we'll get you back on in a month or two to see where things are after this, after they've bought this 30 days or 45 days, or I'm sure they'll go past their 30-day time limit again, but hopefully within 60 days, they'll respond and we'll have some more progress. I wanted to get your ideas on this news story I saw today where Biden's approval ratings have hit an all-time low. And I don't want to just, you know, kind of dunk on him, although it's very easy to do. But I want to think through what are the steps that he will most likely take in order to improve that, even though those steps most likely will be in vain. But what do you think the administration does from here to salvage or improve his rating? And then how do you think that affects the midterms?
I think a twofold approach. One will be to try to motivate the base with some Bernie-style policy proposals.
Okay.
So hence the billionaire tax that's really just a disguised illegal property tax. But you know, they're not going to start it off with taxing working people. You know, the income tax. Congress said we'll never tax a hair on a working man's head. People can figure out how well that worked out. So the the billionaire tax, just a disguised property tax. It's unconstitutional. The 16th Amendment, the definition of income is not that broad, as the Supreme Court has previously stated. But he knows it will sound, it won't be something he can get through. It'll be something to rhetorically sound good. He'll look probably to the Truman 1948 platform style, when Truman was in trouble with inflation and the vestigial effects of World War II. He went back to proposing a bunch of Bernie style left wing quasi-populist ideas.
Oh, so I didn't know that. Truman did that.
Yeah. Truman in 1948, that's what he ran on. He goes, I'm going to give it to them and they're going to like it. And he rallied the old Democratic working class base with farmers and blue collar. It was the most class divided election until 2016 was 1948. And it was, you know, tax the big guys, tax the powerful people, spend for the poor, spend for the people, those kind of proposals. And it was the populist part of the New Deal. And it got him in. It didn't sustain him for very long because the Korean War was a debacle and he was a disaster, but it got him elected. So knowing Biden, he's an old school Democrat, you'll see him look at a lot of Bernie style proposals and probably reinvigorate those proposals, tax the billionaires. You're already seeing it with a lot of the pitch out there is the problem isn't high prices. The problem is big corporations are using the economic issues to steal from you.
Yeah, they're greedy capitalists. They're the reason for the high price.
Greedy capitalists.
Putin and capitalists. They're the reason why the Putin price.
Between Putin and it's the combination. That will be probably the second objective. He will be tempted to send troops to into U.S. troops. There are already special forces there. U.S. troops into Ukraine. That's why we see like what appear to me and other people to be just false flag events, but however you characterize them, Gulf of Tonkin style, you know, remember, you know, to hell with Spain, remember the Maine. That was the first time we got involved in a war based on a false flag. The incubator babies in Iraq, weapons of mass destruction being the most recent famous one. So, and they've been doing this almost every other day. The problem is the story tends to fall apart. You know, Russian atrocities, they're killing civilians, they're killing grandma, they're killing kids, they're chemical weapons, they're bombing schools, they're bombing theaters, they're bombing hospitals. But it just hasn't worked enough in the West. And the problem Biden has is America's deeply an anti-war country historically. You know, John Quincy Adams' famous speech, we do not go searching abroad for monsters to destroy. Lest we become the monster ourselves. We are America. We defend liberty by our example, not by our interventions. And that's the longest historical trend for which our military interventions in the 20th century are an exception. And almost none of them were popular. You know, after World War I, supposedly successful, the war party gets crushed in 1920, the Democrats. After World War II, the Democrats lose the House for the first time in a quarter of a century in 1946. After the Korean War, Truman loses, the Democratic Party loses in 1952. After when Vietnam peaked, and that's what a lot of people are comparing Biden to. They're saying, look to LBJ. What did LBJ do? Massive spending and more intervention in foreign wars. Now, Biden doesn't have the votes to do massive spending through Congress. That doesn't mean he won't try to start circumventing that with executive decrees, some sort of actions. Now,
forgiving student loan debt. I mean, that's kind of a roundabout way to do stimmy checks, kind of.
Exactly. And there'll be massive pressure on him to at least propose that before the end of the year and try to take some executive action in that capacity. He's already using his executive power to just open the doors on immigration, though that's not a long-term popular solution for the Democratic Party. It's a long-term solution in their minds, not a short-term solution. So we'll see but he doesn't have the votes like LBJ did to get a lot of stuff through the House. And he doesn't have enough public support, the threat and specter of communism in the Gulf of Tonkin, to be able to get us further into Ukraine. The more Americans look at Ukraine, the more they want to get out of Ukraine. The more people know about the war, according to public opinion polls, the less likely they're into getting into it. And it's another example where Twitter is not the real world. The Twitteratis who are ready to go to war, who can't wait to send Americans over there to die for some other cause, do not reflect blue collar opinion in Michigan, in places like that. So I don't think these strategies will work for the midterms. The last thing is they're clearly experimenting with more lockdowns. Philadelphia is reinstating mask mandates.
I was going to ask you about that.
And so they will be tempted by that. The problem is there has been so much pushback politically, so much pushback legally, all the lawsuits that have been filed. For example, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals just held the state of Minnesota is going to have to write a bunch of checks for all of their shutting down of particular businesses and industries because they determined that what they did in the case of landlords, that their eviction moratorium was a massive takings in violation of the Fifth Amendment, which means they're going to have to start writing checks to landlords all across the state. And you can bet every landlord in the country is going to start filing suit based on that.
Right.
And that means they have to pay for the value of the property taken. And under some standards, it's the full value of the property, not just the rental value of the property, because depriving them of the rental value was a full taking of that property. So
is that in the case that they lost the property, or even if they just lost the revenue from the rental income?
All they did is, well, technically in the legal terms, it was losing the right of ownership of the property because you weren't allowed to evict people.
Okay.
Technically the title didn't transfer, but under the law, it's considered the same as if they took your whole property because they took a key that if you can't exclude somebody from it, what property right do you really have in it if somebody else is squatting in it? Isn't that the same as, at least for that period of time, transferring title? Isn't it, in fact, in some cases worse because of some of the damage that was done by some of these tenants? And so when you look, I mean, that's a big check. When you look at how big that is, you look at what the CDC did, you look at how many landlords in the, and that's just the landlords. What happens if they extend this to all the businesses that got locked down? To me, it was a taking because they want a taking is whenever they tell a small group of people, you have to pay the price for something of that's going to benefit the whole community. Now, I have good argument this did not benefit the whole community, but putting that aside, that was the political premise for this action was you have to shut down so the whole community will be safe. And this is like when they take somebody's property to build a highway or to build a dam or anything else. And under our Fifth Amendment, the government's supposed to pay you for that. That's been a taking and you are entitled to, quote, just compensation, which can sometimes be more than the market value. It depends on the circumstance. Sometimes less, depending on the circumstances too. But think about how big a check that is for all of those lockdown victims in businesses. I mean, many businesses lost their business because I think it's about, they estimate almost 1 in 5 California businesses went under and haven't been able to come back. Because your small businesses, they just couldn't afford that gap. And many of them didn't qualify for paycheck protection, STEMI checks. Because they didn't have ongoing bank accounts and lines of credit with an established bank that was politically connected.
Yeah, and they weren't, quote-unquote, essential, Robert. But yeah. Amazon was essential.
Yeah, exactly.
The corporations were essential, but the small and mid-sized businesses were not.
Exactly. My buddy of mine solely dodged it because he owns one of the Junk Kings in Tennessee, and they determined that removal of junk was an essential business. So that's how he was able to survive. Otherwise, he could have been wiped out right at the beginning of the business. So given all of that, all these non-essential businesses that suffered massive economic losses in the trillions of dollars when you add it up, that's a lot of money for a lot of governments to owe that they're not even going to have the means to necessarily pay. So given those legal and political problems, that really presents a practical hurdle to governments trying to reinstate and reinstitute lockdowns.
So what are they doing in Philly? Like what is their motivation? This doesn't make any sense to me. It's even the CDC has come out and said that cloth masks really don't work that well. And so, you know, and not only that, but I don't know if you follow Jim Bianco on Twitter, but he had a great chart the other day because their excuse was, well, the 7-day moving average has gone up by like 50% or something like that. So what he did is he showed a chart of 2 weeks where it shows it just going up slightly, but then he zoomed out and showed a chart of like the last year. And it's just a little teeny, weeny, weeny blip. Like you can't even see it on the chart because the baseline is so low. So what on earth are they thinking? And this dovetails into another question that I wanted to ask you about, that the airlines are really pushing back on having to wear masks on the plane. You know, the CEOs have come out and explained it, I think, pretty well, that because of the filters and whatnot, it really doesn't do that much. And we know that it's not doing anything because half the people on the plane aren't even wearing a mask because they're eating their peanuts or drinking their cocktail. So we all know that this is just theater at best. And so, but I know that the administration came out today and said that they were extending this like another 3 weeks or something, like that's going to save lives. So what do you think is the motivation behind extending these mask mandates on planes another 3 weeks and the mask mandate in Philly with the backdrop of everything that you just said?
Precisely. I think there's a politically conflicting internal messaging. So on the one hand, they love the power. I mean, that's what all these politicians live for. And this is the greatest pretext for power. Like I always give as an example, not as much China as Cuba. Cuba still is convincing its population that it stopped COVID because of its lockdowns. What it did is it stopped its tourism economy and helped trigger mass protest in the country that they had to massively repress. But it's because if you're one of these governmental types that loves control, it's the ultimate self-justification. We saved lives. Right. And so they're still so emotionally and psychologically attached to this that the fact that it's long divorced from any empirical evidence, long divorced from even correlation. It's like, how do you can't get to causation if you don't even have correlation. And everywhere, doesn't matter where you look, town to town, school to school, state to state, country to country, at every level, there is not even a correlation between mask mandates and improved COVID health.
Right.
And so how can you keep pretending that this is the case? It's because it was your self-justification for your power in the first place. You know, this managerial class, this professional class, this political class, this bureaucratic class, it justifies why they exist and it justifies their power over everybody. And so it's so built in, they can't help themselves, even when not only are they facing massive economic blowback and political blowback, Democratic pollsters have been telling them now for months, ever since they almost lost the New Jersey governorship that was supposed to be unlosable. They did lose the Virginia governorship. These were double-digit Biden states. Pollsters have been telling the Democratic Party, stay away from this, take credit, but please, God, don't do any more lockdowns, any more mandates, anything related to COVID. It's got to be over or we're DOA politically in November. But they just can't help themselves because it's what justifies them. It's what rationalizes them. It's what they down deep. It's why they go home and they watch Rachel Maddow and re-believe in it all over again and convince themselves they saved millions of lives with this insanity. So the moment they see anything that they can call a blip on the screen, they can scream, we've got to go out and shut everything down again, lock it down again, stick on the mask, all the rest. And they're facing two major lawsuits right now. Stewardesses got together and filed a great class action case where they detailed not only the lack of health benefits due to, as what you note, the air filtration system in airplanes is so good that there was never a COVID outbreak tied to an airplane travel. But these stewardesses document the bad health consequences of them having to wear these masks all day. And they go through all the list of what the medical data and medical information is. So they filed a class action suit to get rid of this, and 19 governors have joined together to file a class action against the mask mandate of the Biden administration. So he's extending this when he's right about to lose a lawsuit within a week or two. One of these courts is likely to issue an injunction saying this is unconstitutional because it was always unconstitutional. The CDC and the federal government does not have the power to impose medical Sharia law on the entire country, and they never did.
So what I just wrote down is a story that I read yesterday, or maybe the day prior. I sent out a tweet, and it's regarding the mask mandates in the airports. And I don't know if you saw this, but Love Field in Dallas, you know, I think their main deal there is with Southwest Airlines. They're implementing these 7-foot tall robots. Did you see this?
No, I did not.
You can look. I wish I was making this up, but I actually went to the source document. It's like the Dallas News. It wasn't just Zero Hedge or something. And they're putting in these 7-foot tall robots that have like facial recognition, and they're putting them in the terminal and in the baggage claim and whatnot. So if you walk by and you're not wearing a mask, they can tell. And you know, their head turns or something like that. They're robots, but they're like these cylinder, like these 7-foot tall cylinder things. And they've got a screen on the front. And then if they see you without a mask, then they basically yell at you to put your mask on. And it's like, you know, how can anyone, A, be in favor of this, but B, not look at that and say, wow, that's a slippery slope to a complete surveillance police state. And, you know, and they're, but what's bizarre is they're doing this at the tail end, what is most likely the tail end of these mandates. So how do you think that plays into the bigger picture?
I think what they still fail to appreciate is the scale and scope of this political unpopularity. You see it in this addiction to power that the pandemic fed, where you have the World Health Organization saying, we want all the world's countries to sign a treaty that gives us, the World Health Organization, complete governmental control over your country in cases of a pandemic, which, by the way, if you dig into the treaty proposal, includes control over supply chain issues, which means that's economic control. So you'd have some bureaucrat at the World Health Organization dictating economic policy for the entire globe. And they think this is a good idea and will be popular in the world. And you see it also in China. You know, China locking down Shanghai again because they've built into their population that they saved them from COVID with their prior lockdowns. And so now they're locked into this crazy circular logic that is leading people to scream from their balconies they need help in Shanghai. So, and in, you know, so it's not even something that's rational, but it's what happens when you have a bunch of commie bureaucrats run your country.
I'm sorry, Robert, to interrupt your train of thought there, but let me get this straight, because this is something I've been trying to figure out for a couple of days now, because these lockdowns in Shanghai, they make absolutely zero sense when you look at it through the lens of the Omicron variant, which is extremely mild. I'm just trying to piece together, you know, what on earth is going on behind the scenes. But that's a good theory that I haven't really heard. And that, and if I'm understanding you correctly, the fact that they did this in the past, and even if it didn't work, they can claim that it did. But if they have another spike in cases and they don't lock down, well, then basically what they're admitting to is what they did in the past was all for nothing. So they're backed into a corner where they have to respond with these draconian measures or admit that they made a mistake, and they would rather take the draconian measures. Is that your take on what's happening in China right now?
Absolutely. And okay, we're just seeing minor versions of it in the rest of the world. That the people that would look to the Chinese communist bureaucratic model and say, geez, that's a wonderful governmental model. And there's a plenty of people in the West that sadly think that way. Trudeau in Canada is clearly, he was like, wow, wouldn't it be great to have that power?
Right.
That's the same reason why China's doing it on the scale they're doing it, even though it's patently irrational, and they have to know it's patently irrational, is because they're locked into the logic for justifying why they control the whole country. You know, we control the country because we can do things like lock you down and save you from COVID. Well, that means every pandemic that comes along, they have to lock you down over and over again to keep pretending that protects you from the disease. And all it does is massively disrupt your economy and trigger massive protests.
Right.
And so, and that's why people are leaking out the footage. I mean, some of it's been exaggerated in the Western press that's anti-China for various reasons, but large parts of it are accurate. I have friends of mine that are on the ground there in China, and they're saying, yeah, and they explain this logic to me. They have no choice. They say, here in China, this was the justification for the lockdowns, as they saved us. But it was more importantly, the justification for the governmental structure as it exists. Why do we have this power? Because we can save you from a disease. So that means they got to keep doing this nonsense, even though it's going to brutalize their economy and undermine them politically long term.
Yeah. Wow. It makes you kind of wonder what their end game is, because it's not like COVID's going away. You can't eradicate it. It's going to be with us forever. So you're going to continually have just these spikes, which hopefully won't lead to, I mean, in fact, the CNBC article that I was reading that was referencing the Shanghai lockdown specifically even said that since, you know, they went into this lockdown, or even prior to that, since they had this most recent outbreak, they've had zero deaths as a result of this spike in cases. Zero deaths. So, you know, again, I don't know, you know, when this comes up in 2 years, in 3 years, in 10 years, are they still locking down every single time that there's a spike in COVID cases just to justify their existence?
I think that's where the logic is. And you look at a place like China, they never learned their lesson, at least back in the day. I mean, you know, Mao had how many great leap forward? It was like, okay, that one, we killed 2 million. Oh, let's try it again. Oh, we killed 5 million. Well, let's try it one more time. Oh, we killed 10 million. It's somebody else's fault. We'll do it again. I mean, just one disaster. So they haven't fully, they believe just self-justifying their power is more important to the continuation of their power than that the use of their power actually benefit the population. Mm-hmm. They've learned the wrong lesson over time. And I think that's why we're going to see them, you know, have to learn it the hard way by mass political protest, major economic disruption, like you're seeing in Europe. Like Europe's discovering the limitations of its power to leverage its countries for kind of a globalist kind of agenda, when all of a sudden you can't afford, you have German industry coming out and saying, our economy will collapse if we actually cut off Russian oil. This is not a practical strategy. This is a way of saying, we're going to fight you, Putin, but watch this. I want to punch myself in the face.
Exactly. And, oh, exactly the analogy you. I've been using. Exactly.
I'm going to punch myself twice in the face, four times in my face. I'm really beating up Putin now.
Yeah.
That's the logic of it.
That's the exact analogy I've been using on my videos, Robert. Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist Show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today. So I want to go back a bit here and try to think through. I don't want to really get into what's happening with Russia, Ukraine, but more so how the media in the West is presenting it. Do you think they're intentionally presenting it in a way that will increase the probability that the United States goes to war? Because either, you know, I don't know what their hidden agenda is. It might just be as plain as, well, they want to help out the Biden administration, and they see this, although, you know, going to war wouldn't be good, it's all for the benefit of society long term. You know, that's their twisted kind of pretzel logic there. How do you see what's happening in Russia, Ukraine, and how the media is presenting it, and what do you think their motives are?
I think it's twofold. One is the globalist George Soros types have always seen Russia as a deep problem and Putin as a particular problem. So Soros has identified Putin as the number one enemy of progress, as he sees it, for going on almost 20 years now. And so I think from their agenda, Russia should be a colony that is a part of this sort of Western global international monetary structure, that a small group of people, stakeholders, as Klaus Schwab would call them, at the top govern the rest of us. And they use an interdependent economy and their control of the financial system to achieve that level of control over the population. And the WHO is just the health version of that. Mm-hmm. And so, Putin has not been on board with that for a while. He's a nationalist, basically, at heart. So in the late 90s, he even wrote a thesis paper that he actually stole. He plagiarized almost his entire thesis paper, but he took it from the University of Pittsburgh authors who said resources are real power, not currencies, not right. consumption. Consequently, he's been building a model that's an anti-globalist model for 20 years and on an accelerated scale for the last 10. Mm. And so they have seen him as he is the greatest threat to our unipolar globalist controlled environment. And so that's part reason one for the media is very much on board with that agenda, whether they understand it overtly or it's just been done covertly. So they have to be, Putin has to be destroyed. Russia has to be destroyed. This counterexample cannot exist. It's like what William Appleman Williams would argue in The Contours of American History, that global empires are particularly concerned with the Cubas of the world, even though Cuba is a tiny little country, it being an example that triggers a whole bunch of problems elsewhere. Russia was that for Soros and Schwab and that whole Davos crowd and the Bilderberg crowd. So that's part one, is they've got to crush Russia. Now, I think they really believed their economic war would work. They had bought their own. They had really believed that if we control the currency, the global currency, if we control the governments that control the financial system, the International Monetary Fund, SWIFT, the World Bank, the means of that the economy is so interdependent that it's actually dependent on them. And that all we got to do is turn off the switch and Russia's lights go out and ball game over. And we just got to find an excuse to drag to do that. So we just provoke, and we keep poking the Russian bear until the Russian bear crosses a border. Then we use that as the pretext. What I don't think they realized, if they had studied it or understood economics well enough, either one, is that Putin had wanted them to use those sanctions so that he could launch his counter-economic war against the global West. He wanted to take down the dollar as dominant. He wanted to take down the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund as dominant. They're talking about creating independent BRICS, Brazil, India, China, Russia, South Africa, the BRICS countries, and others are talking about, let's create our own credit rating system for sovereign bonds. Let's create our own independent IMF, our own independent World Bank, our own independent commodity-driven currency pool or basket, however it's done. Create our own separate, they already were creating a system separate from SWIFT. They already, but start instituting that globally, start trading in our domestic currencies or in currencies other than the dollar, other than the euro. And the arrogance of the West led them to think this was not possible. That's why Biden makes a State of the Union speech where he says the ruble will be rubble within a week.
Yeah, you put that on Twitter too.
Yeah, it's now higher than it was when this whole thing started.
Right.
So if you look at all of those dynamics, they hadn't prepared for it. So then the question is, what next? Well, once you know these people are so dedicated to destroying Russia at all costs, and always ask yourself this, who is going to want a global digital currency after this? I mean, who's going to want any country's digital currency after this? Definitely not the West digital currency. So one of their grand objectives of massive global control is massively at risk if Russia wins. So they can't afford Russia to win. So that means that since they're losing economically, they have to shift to military. They have to create a military loss for Russia that could undermine and overthrow the Russian government. So there'll be massive pressure on getting NATO countries, including the United States, into the war, because they believe the Russian military, despite the propaganda that they're trying to spin that Ukraine was winning and could win the war, they don't down deep believe that. It is a NATO-trained unit. It has lots of munitions, lots of ballistics. Ukraine, whichever side you're on politically, the Ukrainians have every motivation to fight, because for the last two decades, they've been taught a narrative that says Russia's the source of their problems going back three centuries. There's a lot of Russian side historians that would say that's false. It's made up by the West, but doesn't matter. Ukraine, a large number of Ukrainians believe it to be true. And that's all that's relevant for purposes of their willingness to fight. But so you've got a very willing army, a very well-trained army. You've got almost over a quarter of a million soldiers in the field. You have another 4 million you could conscript. You've got billions of munitions flowing in across the borders every day. And you've got the satellite system of the U.S. using its people on the ground of commanders. A French reporter from Le Figaro just confirmed that yesterday, that America is basically running the battle strategy for Ukraine. And so you have a proxy NATO army that's actually better trained, better armed, more sophisticated than, say, neighboring Poland.
Right.
But the problem is Russia is still a million, it's one of the strongest armies in the world. It's like one of the things that the globalists didn't like is Putin took Russia's military budget from $6 billion a year to $67 billion a year. right? He increased it tenfold. He increased particularly sophisticated weapons. Russians have weapons that can induce tsunamis in different parts of the world. This is why when people start talking about World War III, you know, like George C. Scott, you know, I'm not saying we won't, you know, Dr. Strangelove, I'm not saying we won't get our hair, you know, buzzed a little bit, you know, 10 million, 20 million tops, nuclear war. You know, you have that kind of conversation taking place in the West. They're that nuts. They've won. They're that desperate because globalists see Putin as a potential terminal threat to their project, particularly to the George Soros version of that globalist project. But he has extraordinary influence, but he reflects the Rockefellers and the other types as well. And at the same time, they're naive about the military aspects of the potential consequences, or they're willing to risk it. They're willing to actually, I mean, Russians have weapons that can induce tsunamis. I mean, they have nuclear drone submarines, mini sub. I mean, all kinds of crazy weapon, hypersonic missiles that they've been showing off. This is not a country that have the most nuclear weapons, of course, in the world. This is not a country to go to war with, to find out whether they're serious. that's literally like going right up to the big Russian bear and, you know, keep poking him and poking him right next to him and see what happens when you get a bear mad and you're within 4 feet of him. Doesn't turn out good. So I think that's why the media propaganda is definitely going to try to get us on the ground. And if you look at it right now, it looks like the script to Vietnam. You know, first we send in arms, then we send in advisors, then we use propaganda to send in troops. And I think, and if you're Biden and you're in the 30s, dipping down in the low 20s, you're going to get crushed, record-setting losses. The, you know, some deep state connected people are threatening to indict, probably is part of the reason they're threatening to indict your son and your family for corruption is to extort you to go along with this more aggressive LBJ style Vietnam War agenda. It brings massive pressure from multiple places for him to drag us into world war. And they have the benefit of the complicity of so many Republicans in positions of power because Republican senators and House members have endorsed all of this xenophobic almost type. Let's get involved in the war. Russia is terrible and horrible and awful and evil. Let's get in the middle of what is a European civil war, which is contrary to what our founders wanted. But that means it would be politically difficult for Republicans to try to push back if he gets troops on the grounds in Ukraine. And that could be, I mean, it saved the 9/11 and going into Afghanistan and then Iraq took W, who was sinking before then, right back in because we'd had the 99.com bomb and the stock, you know, fall apart. We had major underlying economic issues coming to the fruition. All of a sudden you get 9/11, you get Afghanistan, you get Iraq. And W was able to hold power until 2006 when they lost the House and the Senate. So there's going to be massive political motivations to get us into a ground war in Ukraine.
Yeah, that's one of my biggest concerns is that if you look at the incentive structure around what would benefit the authoritarians, the central planners, the politicians, the global elite, pretty much all of them are incentivized for the United States to get involved with Russia, Ukraine, and that most likely doesn't end well for the average Joe and Jane. That's for sure. I want to go back and get, you know, I know we're running short on time here. So I wanted to definitely get your opinion on this gal that just got elected to the Supreme Court. What's your opinion on how you think she'll vote? Do you think she'll, I'm asking a rhetorical question here, but do you think she'll stand the side of the Constitution as it is what it is, or that it's a living document? What do you think this does for the country, the rule of law moving forward?
I've actually been in front of her in a court case, and it was a politically tinged case. And her way of handling it was to play Pontius Pilate. She kept delaying everything. So she wanted to avoid the embarrassment of ruling on behalf of the corrupt FBI, but also wanted to avoid actually ruling against them. So she just never ruled. The case like dragged on for 4 years. So that gives you an idea for her mindset. She's a hybrid of a kind of neoliberal Breyer who was very much a living constitutional guy, but he was often corporate deferential. So in corporate cases, he would be pro-corporation. That's the neoliberal side, you know, kind of like a socially liberal Wall Street banker kind of personality who likes wokeism, that kind of
right, right.
She'll have a lot of those aspects to her, and she's replacing Breyer. The other side of her personality is very much like Sotomayor, So where she actually might be good is on like criminal defense rights. So when the in Fourth Amendment, she might be good on the Fourth Amendment. Certain issues about the Eighth Amendment, right to bail, she might actually be good on that. But she'll be very much a living constitutionalist for sure, does not believe in original constitutional constraints whatsoever on a judge's actions. She'll institute her political beliefs through the Constitution and enforce those. So it undermines a constitutionally constricted court. But there will be certain areas where her politics aligns with good constitutional analysis. And so she won't be universally bad, but she'll probably be 80% bad.
So where is she? If you're giving her a grade, not necessarily her, but where do you think that puts the future of the Supreme Court in general with her being a part of the mix? Does it make it on net balance? Is it better? Or is it worse? Is it about the same?
It will stay the same for the time being. Now, I think she'll be there a long time. So what she mostly did is extend the longevity of that branch of the court. We're still going to have what I call a 3-3-3 split court. Three liberals, three constitutionally minded conservatives in Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas. And then three, what I call corporatist. Some people would call them centrist. What they really are is they'll defend the system. So now and then they'll pull back on the system, say that's a little too far when they think it's politically too unpopular or unpalatable. But in other places, they'll be very deferential and defensive of the system. In other words, if they had been there in 1945, these three justices are the kind of people that say, yay, Korematsu, no problem. Let's lock up the Japanese, right? They're that kind of people.
Yeah.
But they won't go as far as the three liberals are to remake the country in liberal vision. So that will be their limitation. And they'll be a little bit more sensitive on religious issues. Thus, for example, in vaccine mandates, I think they will ultimately find that vaccine mandates that violate someone's religious rights are illegal and violate the Constitution. That's where they'll be good. Where they'll be bad is they won't take action for a year while the lockdowns are doing their worst damage, which is precisely what they did do. So Roberts, Barrett, and Kavanaugh will be very establishment, moderate-type personalities who are mostly oriented to defending the system, but will occasionally curb the system's excesses when they think it actually endangers the system. Kind of like FDR's approach.
Okay, another legal question I had for you is something that came out recently in the news. California is trying to make it actual law that it would be illegal for businesses, I believe with over 500 employees, to have workers work over 32 hours a week. So basically you're taking it from a 5-day work week down to a 4-day work week, unless they pay them just an astronomical amount of overtime, which of course, this is another blow to small and mid-sized business. And you say, well, how is that, George? Because they don't have 500 employees, because you're in a labor shortage as is. So if you're an employee, why would you not go and work for a corporation with over 500 when you know that you'd have a 32-hour work week instead of the 40-hour work week you have with Ma and Pa on the local corner store? So what are your thoughts on this law? Is this just political theater, or is this something that you think they can actually pass?
It absolutely is something they can pass. I mean, they have, there's a bunch of, I call it California for a reason. About 10 years ago, I told all my clients to get out. I was like, if you can get out, some couldn't, if you're a medical care provider with a long roster of customers and patients, you just can't recreate that somewhere else overnight.
Yeah.
But others that did get out, thank me every day that they got out. I mean, there are things like right now in California, if there's a sexual harassment allegation, you as a business have to refer that to a private vendor that is a state approved private vendor to investigate you. Right. And it quickly started to be weaponized to target people for political reasons or just old fashioned extortion.
Right.
Because these are like little commissars, little Berias. And so California ultimately is going to a system. Their ideal would be the state would have complete control over all business. And they're just doing it indirectly. They're doing it through tax and regulation. I always joke, if you have all the things you have to make notice of in California, just go into one of their like human resources offices or go into one of their kitchens, you know, the kitchen cafeteria, we have to post notices of all the rules. It covers the entire wall. It's like wallpaper because it's all the different rules that exist. And that's just multiplying. They're having to expand their wall space to make more space for all the new rules. So and it's already written in small print. So it's their ultimate goal is state control of every business that operates how they want politically, ideologically. They just lost in court. Judicial Watch brought a good suit because they had required every business in California to have a certain number of people on its board, according to race, gender, sexual preference, sexual identity, yeah, all the rest. Luckily, the court described that as unconstitutional and knocked it down. But it gives an idea. This is just state control of all businesses in disguised form.
What do you think? And did you see that leak that came out from that socialist paper? It's called ProPublica, I believe. I'm sure you're familiar with the newspaper or the publication. But they just had some IRS documents that were leaked to them regarding, the quote unquote rich, the super rich, and how much they actually pay in tax. And I went and looked at the article, and they actually did a really good job of breaking it down and putting it into charts and graphs and everything. But I thought one thing that was very interesting was the group of the top, and they had the top 400 richest people in the United States and the top, I think, 400 income earners as well, which obviously, is a lot different there. But with the top 400 income earners, they showed that the group that pays the least amount of taxes are tech people. So right there in California, and they had data from 2013 to 2018, and their average marginal rate was about 17%. So, we sit there and wonder why all these Facebooks and Googles and Twitters of the world are so woke, and why are they arguing for higher taxes and all of these other, because they don't pay the taxes, and they know that if you create this moat around the business in the sense that a smaller startup would have to pay these taxes, then it reduces their competition. So they're effectively trying to create monopoly through government decree. But I don't know if you saw that that article that came out from ProPublica, but I'd like to get your thoughts on it.
So it's two things. One is what's been happening, especially since Trump got elected, is the political weaponization of IRS personnel to where they're going into people's private tax information that's by law private, and they're leaking it, and they're doing it repeatedly. Originally, they started by targeting Trump-connected people, but after that, they started doing it to any millionaire, billionaire, other people.
Yeah, they had Democrats on. Bloomberg was on there. They even had athletes. They didn't show their marginal tax rate. They showed what they were, some people were making. And it had Bill Gates on there. And they showed, how he gets away with paying, whatever it is, his average marginal tax rate was. I think Bloomberg, ironically enough, had the lowest marginal tax rate of anybody on the list. And which is usually what happens with Democrats, the ones that claim that they want the taxes the most are the ones that are trying to get away paying the least amount of taxes.
That's because the mayor of New York City, the highest tax location in the entire country, when you add city, state, and federal taxes, really lives in Bermuda, according apparently to his tax returns, while he was mayor. So, it's a fascinating component. But so part of that was that was massive criminality by high-ranking IRS personnel, for which none of them have faced any consequence, leaking that private, confidential, legally protected information about an individual. But the second part, and it reflected this buildup, they're going to excuse and justify property taxes by saying they're going to make the super rich pay first. I mean, that's what a lot of these Russian oligarch sanctions are, right? They're getting people excited about the seizure of boats and yachts and buildings and properties, even football clubs in England.
Right. So why not unrealized capital gains?
Exactly. It reminds me of how the Soviets started out seizing everything in Moscow. Let's go seize all the fancy estates and the fancy houses, and you can get the crowd all up in all frothed up.
Yeah, right.
All lathered up. And that's precisely what they, but of course that ends up coming back to ordinary people, because the big tech companies can use, you know, can use various means of transferring intellectual property, various treaties, tax treaties that govern tax law, a whole bunch of things to avoid paying any of this tax. This tax overwhelmingly falls on labor earners. And if you make your money from your labor, then it's much harder to avoid taxation. So it's the person who's your really successful labor earner, your really successful small business person who can't magically shift his revenues to Ireland. That's who gets hammered.
Yeah, the group that they actually showed this, the group that pays the highest marginal rate is the group of income earners that make between like $1 million and $5 million per year. So that would be your job creator right there.
Exactly. It's your entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. But to the state bureaucrat, that's their ultimate adversary.
Right.
Their ultimate adversary isn't the woke corporate executive that you can co-opt in a fascistic enterprise. The real enemy is your independent thinker, independent entrepreneur, independent job provider, independent property holder. That goes all the way back to the Soviet era. Who was their greatest threat? The independent peasant. The independent peasant who had just enough land to be able to provide jobs, employment, and material support to the local community. That is who they hated. That's who they starved out in a famine. It wasn't a Ukrainian-specific famine. It was a farmer, peasant farmer-specific famine. It was no more Cossacks, no more kulaks. And that's been true of the state all the way back from the beginning. And that's why they always target the high-end labor earner, the independent property holder, the independent business person, not the super elite that are politically connected and politically protected. They're coming for ma and pop operations.
That and you can see that in the World Economic Forum. You can see that in the Great Reset Agenda. You can see that we need to go from we need a new form of capitalism. What they'll say, can you what's his name of Salesforce will come out, the Klaus clone, Benioff will come out and say that capitalism is dead. And you know, this is why I think another reason why is because the global elite like to think of themselves as superior to everyone else, and all these dumb rubes in the real economy, well, they are inferior to us. And therefore, it's kind of like that China thing. If you have all the business people and entrepreneurs, they're the dumb rubes. They're not part of the global elite. Therefore, if they're solving all of these problems, if they're growing the economy, if they're solving the problem of, let's say, not enough energy, if they're creating all these jobs, then that makes us look bad. Then that makes us look like we're no longer needed. And maybe that's one of their objectives.
Well, absolutely it is. It goes all the way back to look at Karl Marx versus Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson and our founding fathers considered independent workers, independent property holders, the ultimate foundation of a democratic constitutional republic, most likely to protect it, most likely to defend it, most likely to keep it alive. Who did Marx identify as the ultimate enemy of the people? The same group of people. He called them the petite bourgeois, but that's who he meant. The independent landholder, the independent farmer, the independent worker, the independent job creator, the independent entrepreneur. That's the person that the state and the bureaucrats see as the ultimate enemy, and that's why they're going to be targeted overwhelmingly in all of these kind of laws.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right. Lastly here, Robert, and by the way, you know, I can't remember when we talked about this. I think we talked about it maybe when you spoke at our mastermind group, but we are trying to think through when these mandates would come to an end. And you pretty much called it right on you hit the nail on the head. But just for the audience, can you just give us a quick review as to when you think the will be completely done in the United States with not just the mask mandates, but also having to wear masks on planes? And then if we want to leave the country, how long do you think it'll be until they get rid of the whole negative COVID test? And then how long do you think it'll be until they finally abandon the rule where foreigners have to be vaccinated to get into the country and have a negative test?
I think we're probably about a year away from sort of purging this virus of rampant authoritarianism.
Okay.
And I think we'll see it in a sequence of suits. I mean, as of right now, almost all the Biden mandates have been stopped on federal employees. There's one federal employee mandate that's going back and forth in the Fifth Circuit. You know, it was shut down, then it was reopened, and now it's sort of in between. But all the other ones, the contractor mandate, other mandates, everything except for healthcare workers has been shut down. The private, most city and state and county governments have stopped their mandates, but not all. A bunch are being fought out in the court system. Most private employers pulled back on their mandates, but not all. I'm still fighting Tyson Foods in a bunch of cases throughout the country because they fired everybody, 25-year hardworking employees over this nonsense because the CEO's buddies with the Biden administration and wanted to prove, I mean, here's a chicken maker who wants to prove to the world how woke he is. I mean, it's insanity. But I think it will take another 6 months to a year, a combination of these legal cases going through. I think the Supreme Court will make a ruling on this by the year's end that will say it's illegal to discriminate against people for religious reasons related to these vaccine mandates or other mandates. And that would gut most of these mandates that are left standing. But I think it will take the November elections in 2022 to sufficiently shock the system into finally purging the vestiges of this.
Oh, okay.
And because I think then Biden will feel obligated to try to do something to keep their hopes alive for 2024, especially as what the data you're looking at, we're probably looking at a recession in 2023. And maybe it'll come before then, but probably almost guaranteed by then. So if he has a debacle in November plus a recession, there'll be massive pressure on him to try to whitewash everyone's memory of the disaster of the pandemic of Democratic policies. So that combination will likely lead to the final end of these mandates.
All right. Boy, I sure hope so. All right, buddy. We'll go ahead and leave it there. As always, awesome conversation. For my listeners and viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
One-stop shop for everything that's related to our content, and that's vivabarneslaw.locals.com.
All right, buddy. And you're right there on the homepage, by the way, because I just talked to the local people or the locals guys, and I set up a page there as well. So yeah, check them out. And I think that's where our live stream was the other evening, wasn't it? Was for
you? Yeah, we had one there and had on YouTube too. But I do a lot of exclusive content. Like if you wanted to see a prediction of everything that was going to happen in the Russia-Ukraine war from the very beginning that it started, I had an exclusive, what I call hush-hush, alternative histories analysis that's basically predicted everything that was going to happen. If you'd studied it, you knew it there. But basically, it's, you know, people can post their own exclusive content. It's a troll-free community of interested people who want civil conversation.
Uncensored.
Completely uncensored. I mean, the only person who gets to censor is me.
Yeah, guys. So you got to check out Robert at Locals for sure. All right, buddy. Enjoy the rest of your day and we'll definitely chat soon.
Will do. Peace out.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Do you enjoy watching these interviews I do for the Rebel Capitalist show? Well, if so, you would absolutely love Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the conference I do twice per year, and we've had speakers like Robert Kiyosaki, Lynn Alden, Rick Rule, Jeff Snyder, and Dr. Ron Paul, just to name a few. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com and check out the next event we have scheduled in Miami.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.